and kicking things off for us is someone who needs no introduction, but I'll try anyway. Our former leader, who is often called Leader Emeritus, David Ford, MLA for Southampton. Antrim, even. Southampton. Don't know where Southampton came from. Sure you wish you were there, David, but there you are. So, come on. Thank you.
No, Madam President, I'm quite happy to be in South Antrim most of the time and East Belfast just at the moment. Welcome to the first panel of the day, which is entitled Brexit, a Societal Change, if I could pronounce the word societal. Let me just reflect a little bit about some of the reasons why we've had this panel today. For obvious reasons, most of the discussion that has happened around the issue of the UK leaving the EU has been on economic matters. We saw that most recently at the beginning of the week with complaints from fishing communities across the UK that they would continue to be bound by the common fishing policy during the transition period. But the European Union has always been about a lot more than just economics, a point which was indeed made by Ted Heath, who some of you may remember was Prime Minister when we joined the then EEC in 1973, a point which has become more significant with developments in Europe across the last 45 years. Now, some of you may remember I used to have some responsibilities for justice issues in this community. I now speak for Alliance on Environment and Agriculture, and I know just what proportion of our interaction with Europe is covered by both of those areas. Some weeks ago, for example, I travelled with Stephen Farry and other party representatives down to Dublin, where civil servants from the Department of Foreign Affairs had set up meetings with civil servants from a number of government departments to discuss how leaving the EU would affect North-South relations on this island. One of the most telling points for me was made by a civil servant from the Department of Justice and Equality, whom I used to meet regularly at North-South meetings. And he listed just some of the areas of North-South cooperation in the area of civil and criminal justice, which depend upon EU law. And it isn't just big ticket items like the European arrest warrant, which has attracted attention, and which allows the easy extradition these days of criminal justice suspects north and south. Civil law is just as important. I suspect that few fathers who are defaulting on their maintenance payment will ever flee from Swindon or Swansea to Lisbon or Lyon. But moving from Strabane to Lifford is an entirely different issue. And real serious effects can follow for the women and children left behind. We've also seen in recent years how European legislation has underpinned common environmental standards across Europe, particularly across these islands with the different jurisdictions. And we may well ask if the government's claims about maintaining the highest standards for food quality, for environmental excellence, for animal welfare, could actually survive a trade deal with the USA. So this session is about looking at those issues wider than just trade, to enable us to explore how Brexit will affect health and higher education, the rights of children and young people, the environment, and justice. Let me just say a brief word about how we're running it. I have already been given a number of questions for our four guests. There are, in the hands of stewards, I trust, says he, looking down the hall at Sharon, speaker's cards. If anybody wishes to ask a question, if they stick their hand up, they can get a speaker's card and pass it up, and I'll try to include as many as possible. But initially, I'm going to ask each of the panel to give us a short 3 minutes or so introduction to how they see things at the moment. And after that, it'll be free-for-all questions, which I will endeavour to moderate as best as possible. So can I welcome and thank for turning up this ridiculously early on a Saturday morning our panel. First of all, Hugh McKenna, who is the Dean of the Medical School at Ulster University. He's the one furthest away from me. Then Mairead McCafferty, I always get that name wrong, my apologies, Mairead, who is the person who basically keeps Kula Yasuma in line as Chief Executive of the Commissioner for Children and Young People. Jennifer Fulton leads Northern Ireland Environment Link, and Stephen Martin, Assistant Chief Constable, is an incredibly important person, though now marginally less important in my life than he used to be. Anyway, can I start by inviting Hugh to the rostrum to say a few words?
Thank you very much. Good morning. First, I would like to congratulate the Alliance Party on Next Steps Forward. I think it provides great hope at a time of widespread feelings of hopelessness. I particularly like the recommendations relating to Brexit. And personally, I can say that I am a European citizen, I'm a European health professional, and I am a European academic. To withdraw from the EU, I believe, will diminish my identity, compromise my support for patients, and reduce my ability to produce high-quality research. And I want to spend a couple of moments talking about students, staff, and research funding. Students, first of all. So in 2014-15, EU students contributed £78 million to Northern Ireland economy and supported 840 jobs. They also add to the diversity of our universities, our societies, and our businesses, and help influence Northern Ireland's position around the globe. We know that universities in the continental Europe are preparing for Brexit to lure students away from the UK. The number of courses, for example, taught in universities in continental Europe have increased, taught in English, have increased by 13% in the last year. They provide excellent quality for very low fees, and in some cases, no fees at all. There are no university fees, for example, in Austria or Denmark, just to name two. Compare that with £9,250 fees in GB. When I asked my colleagues in those countries why they don't charge fees for university students, they said, well, it's very simple. Other countries raise those children, support them, educate them, feed and clothe them. They come and they do a degree here and we encourage them to stay, to contribute to our culture, to our society and to our economy. Why would we charge them tuition fees? I think that makes a great deal of sense. At the moment, it'll not surprise you that Queen's and Ulster University get a lot of students from the Republic of Ireland. What's going to happen after Brexit? Will they be treated as international students and be charged exorbitant international fees? We don't know the answer to that yet. In terms of staff, currently, depending on subject, about 20 to 40% of staff in UK universities are EU citizens from outside UK. The uncertainty for these staff is corrosive. My EU colleagues in the university tell me that they're being approached to take up jobs in Holland and Germany and France. And these are staff we already have. What about staff we're trying to attract? Every week I'm hearing from universities that people are deciding not to come to the UK. Uncertainty over Brexit means that the brightest and best are very reticent to take up academic jobs in the UK. What about grants? Well, Horizon 2020 in its lifetime has been worth 80 billion euro. And UK universities are the second largest recipient of this funding source. In fact, we take out 40% more from those EU funds than we put in. In a five-year period, just to take Ulster University, for example, we were awarded £20 million in EU funding. It's quite simply the most outstanding and best funding system in the world, and even if we tried, we could not personally produce one of our own. Currently, EU universities coordinate one in five Horizon 2020 funded projects. However, this week, just published on Tuesday, a survey conducted by UniLion found that research collaborations with UK partners had stagnated or decreased. The preference for EU universities is to work with non-EU partners. It's too risky for them to partner with us. So if a deal is not struck between the UK government and the European Commission, we will lose access to Framework 9, which is the successor of Horizon 2020. So to conclude, every single university in the UK has come out against Brexit. Every single one. That's about 140. Because of the negative effect, as I say, on students and staff and on funding. Interestingly, though, the Welsh Government is designing a £50 million impact fund to help universities and businesses deal with the fallout of Brexit. The Scottish Parliament has launched an inquiry into EU funds to the nation and what can be done to replace them. However, the storm and collapse has meant that as far as Brexit negotiations are concerned, Northern Ireland is on the outside looking in. So I believe there are no reasons left why we should not take Alliance's Next Steps Forward for Brexit seriously. There are only excuses. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Hugh. Mairead, next, please.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak here today at the conference Obviously, as David's already said, as Chief Executive at the Office of the Commissioner for Children and Young People, my job is, apart from keeping Coolah in line, as David said, is also very much about making sure that our mission in terms of safeguarding and promoting the rights of children and young people across Northern Ireland are actually respected. And I know we've only got 3 minutes, so I'll try and stick within that. As everybody will be aware, young people were not consulted in relation to Brexit. They didn't have a vote in relation to Brexit and very much were invisible in the whole debate and negotiations leading up to the referendum and negotiations since. One of the things that we have to do in our work is make sure the voice of children and young people is heard on all matters affecting their lives. And this is in line with Article 12 of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. So I'll tell you briefly a bit about what we've done so far, and I want to flag up some of the issues that have been highlighted by the young people themselves. We did a huge piece of work last year, which is still ongoing, in relation to young people in Northern Ireland, but also with our counterparts in the South, the Ombudsman for Children in Ireland as well, because we knew that young people were very exercised about the fact they felt excluded from the whole negotiation process around Brexit, and they also felt that adults in our society were gambling with our futures without even listening to their concerns. So what we did was a huge project jointly cross-border. We had the young people set up a steering group, which culminated in a huge piece of work around the issues affecting them, as they say it, in their daily lives. But then we had a conference last November in Newry. And this brought together over 120 young people from all across the island of Ireland. And we also brought MEPs, TDs, MLAs, and various government officials from North and South to that as well. The young people ran the event. They were the ones who were asking the questions and facilitating all the roundtable discussions on the various themes. They've produced a report following that conference. I do have a few copies with me, but you can also access it on our website. So I would encourage everyone to access the report. And there's also a summary document as well, if you're in a hurry and you want to read something quickly. One of the things we've done is take the young people, since we've published the report, over to Westminster, because we wanted to make sure that our young people had a voice at the heart of the decision-making processes. We met with the chair of the Committee for Exiting the EU, Hilary Benn. We met with the Undersecretary of State. We met with a number of members of the House of Lords, Lord Brown, Lord McConnell, Baroness Lister, Meacher, Baroness Sudi, and so on. And there was a debate that afternoon in the House of Lords, and the fact that we had a delegation of young people over from Northern Ireland to voice their concerns and to present the report to the Lords was actually referenced in that. And I will speak in relation to some of the issues that they've raised as well. Just to also let you know as well that just last week we took a delegation of young people from the north of Ireland and from the south to Brussels. And they met with the Task Force, 50 members. They met also with Danuta Hubner, who's the Chair of Constitutional Affairs in the European Union as well. And we also met with the permanent representations for Northern Ireland and from the Republic of Ireland as well. This was very much about providing a vehicle and a platform for our young people to bring their concerns, voice the issues to those who are making the decisions that are going to be affecting their lives much longer, certainly, than mine and others of us in the audience of a certain age as well. So in terms of the issues, and David's already referenced the fact that children and young people's rights is very much to the fore in this. And in terms of children's rights, it's also about access to services. It's also very much about issues of identity and passports. We have young people who were saying, what happens if I just have a British passport and I don't want to get an Irish passport? Does that mean my rights are compromised? These are the kinds of issues that we brought up with Nina Obermeyer, the chair of the task force. We're also mindful as well that children are very exercised, that we have non-discrimination continuing. We want to make sure that we protect all of the rights that we have to date, and that there is non-regression of rights, but also that equality is very much protected going forward, and that non-discrimination is obviously applied, particularly in relation to non-EU citizens here, and certainly among the migrant community and our newcomer children as well. We're very keen, and in terms of what the young people were saying, it was very much about looking after the Good Friday Agreement, and you will have heard repeatedly said in the media, and it was said again last week in Brussels after the debate on the Monday of the 19th of March, that it will be protected in all of its parts, and they're in negotiations, obviously, in terms of the processes about how do we do that and how do we reconcile that with some of the statements that are coming out of the Westminster government as well. We very much welcome what's in the EU withdrawal bill, which is based on the joint report that was issued in December 17. One of the big things for everyone, as no one will be surprised about, is the border and the impact of the border. It's very much about the freedom of movement of people, of goods, of services and of capital. And the young, even though we know that the common travel area is going to be respected, we also have to be mindful of some of the statements that have been coming back, and certainly as part of the referendum campaign about taking back control of our borders. We've also heard statements more recently that there won't be a hard border. So it's how we actually reconcile that with taking back control, but obviously leaving the customs union and the single market as well. Young people were very exercised about the right to family life. We have young people who were telling us that if their parents have been divorced or are separated, they live with one parent in the south of Ireland, but they travel north to visit their other parent. Young people, 2,000 young people travel across the border every single day to go to school, north and south. We know that there's 30,000 border crossings every day in relation to the border. So I think everyone agrees that there shouldn't be a hard border, that the common travel area needs to be respected, but it's how we reconcile that with some of the other statements that are coming out. In terms of access to services and health, and we know that there's the Centre of Excellence in Dublin in terms of paediatric cardiology, and we have to make sure that our children and babies who need that service have it unimpeded. We also know that cancer services in Altnagelvin are another centre of excellence, which again, there's a lot of cross-border traffic on as well. So again, that has to be protected. I know Hugh's already referenced some of the experience of students in universities as well. One of the things that young people raised with us as well was around Erasmus and access to that. Now, when we spoke to the task force last week, they said that this should be able to be continued. There are something like 142 different areas that have already been mapped, if you like, and agreed in quotation marks, because as everybody knows, nothing is agreed until everything's agreed, and this is the repeated mantra that we're hearing all of the time. One of the big things that did concern young people, particularly those in rural communities, was around the economy, and I know that the whole focus of the Brexit negotiations appears to have been on the economy, but this is about standard of living. This is about child poverty. 87% of farmers relied last year on EU subsidies in terms of CAP. If we take that away, then the levels of child poverty in rural areas will obviously increase. So we need to be speaking to government and to the EU about how we retain those subsidies and how that can make sure that we don't see rising levels of child poverty. And I see that one of the issues on the agenda and the programme for the conference this weekend is around child poverty. We currently have over 100,000 living in poverty in Northern Ireland. We do not want that to rise. We want to eradicate that and make sure that government does everything it needs to do so. One of the other big issues, just to touch on, and I'm sure that Stephen will talk more about this as well, is around safeguarding and child protection. We know there are issues with missing children, children who are abducted, who are taken across the border. We know that there are children who are trafficked through and to Northern Ireland. So we therefore need to make sure that we retain all of the security and policing mechanisms that currently exist. David's already referenced the European arrest warrant. We have to make sure that we're still liaising in terms of criminal records information systems through ECRIS, through Europol, through Eurojust, and we have to make sure that, and I know that Lord Brian actually said this in the House on the 19th of March, It's very much about looking at the particular needs of children and young people in Northern Ireland here in relation to the border because of the recent conflict, because of the trauma that we're still managing here in Northern Ireland, but also about making sure that children and young people's lives don't go back. We have heard a number of times from children and young people saying, does this mean we'll see soldiers back on our streets? Does this mean it'll be dangerous? Will there be checkpoints up on the border? We do not want to go back to the bad old days of the past. Northern Ireland has very much moved forward and we want to continue that as well.
Mairead, I'm afraid you're in danger of answering all the questions.
I'll just finish there actually by saying, obviously we do have concerns around the destabilising impact potentially of some citizens in Northern Ireland having Irish passports or the right to have Irish passports and those who don't or choose not to take that up. And there is a concern around the equivalency of rights across the island, so it is something we need to make sure that we're actually vigilant about. So I'll stop there. Needless to say, we are continuing our work, but I look forward to the questions later. Thanks very much, everybody.
Next, Jennifer, please.
Thank you very much for the invite to be with you this morning. With the world of the environment, it's very complex Brexit, so we have hundreds of pieces of environmental legislation, all of which are governed by the EU. So I'm not going to attempt to cover all that in detail, just a very simple look at where we are and the challenges ahead. And if you look at that legislation, it affects everybody's lives on a daily basis. So over the last 40 years, you've had the protection of air quality directives. You've had EU directives that govern the water quality, the quality of the water that comes out of your tap, the type, the quality of the water that your children swim in the sea. So there's so many issues in there that we need to think about as we Brexit, and there's a lot of very serious decisions to be made. So lots of challenges ahead, and we need to think about the intergenerational impact, because the decisions we make during the next few years will impact for several generations, not just one. So lots to think about, and we also have to think about environmental standards and how we avoid a race to the bottom. We've moved on considerably in the last 40 years, and we certainly don't want to see any backward movement. The one thing about the European Union is it takes the health of its citizens really seriously, and also the natural world that we all depend on. So somehow, as we Brexit, we need to consolidate on the achievements to date and make those even better moving forward. But fortunately, in the area of the environment, there is quite a lot of strategic thinking going on at a UK level. So you have the Westminster government, who want to be the first generation to leave the environment in a better state than they found it. So there's lots of things happening, and just recently, we've seen the release of a 25-year plan from Michael Gove, which is Health and Harmony, the Future for Food, Farming and the Environment. So what we want to see as a sector in Northern Ireland is how we get that balance right, how we have a sustainable agricultural industry, but also meet all the environmental standards that we need, not just for citizens, but also to trade in any new trade agreements with WTO. So we need lots of leadership, and the good thing about Alliance is we've got lots of good strategists amongst your politicians, so we're hoping that that will help as we all discuss and agree the way forward. So the environment is a really important area to look at. We've also had the command paper released on agriculture from Michael Gove. So there's lots of things that your party can feed into in terms of policy. Lots of debates going on around whether environmental governance should be UK-focused or devolved, which is causing some differences of opinion throughout the devolved regions. So there's lots of work to do. But looking forward, it's easy to get depressed and think about everything that we're losing and how things could get worse, but what we need to do is find a way to make it better. And that's really what we as a sector are working on. So we're linking in with other similar organisations in the rest of the UK and also in the Republic of Ireland. So like many of the speakers, we have been to and fro, and also to Europe. So we've met the Article 50 Task Force. We regularly liaise with our counterparts in London, in Edinburgh, in Cardiff, and we're trying to have a very consistent message that protects the whole of the UK. And that seems to be having some traction. So it's how we keep that momentum going. But as I said, it's something which we all need to think about because it is going to affect your daily lives. So really important that the Alliance Party inputs into that process. And you do have some very good experience from previous posts, as David and Anna and others have quite in-depth knowledge of the environment.
I have to say thank you for that compliment, Jennifer. Finally, Stephen.
Well, good morning, everybody, and thank you very much for the kind invitation to take part in this panel. This discussion comes at a frustrating stage in the Brexit negotiations. We're starting to get some sense of broad outlines to possible solutions, but we still lack sufficient clarity to inform concrete planning. However, in spite of this uncertainty, I've been tasked by the Chief Constable to lead on the PSNI's work to prepare the service to respond to the eventual outcomes. So from my perspective, I see potential impacts for us in policing in four key areas. First of all, security. Secondly, policing in border areas. Thirdly, cross-border crime. And fourthly, criminal justice powers and legislation. So from the perspective of security, firstly, the threat level in Northern Ireland from Northern Ireland-related terrorism remains severe. That means an attack is highly likely. So there were 5 national security attacks in Northern Ireland last year, but I can assure you many others were thwarted and impeded. Our continuing efforts in countering those who seek to use violence in pursuing political goals relies heavily on our cooperation with An Garda Síochána. The commitment of the Garda in supporting our efforts has denied dissident Republicans any opportunities to seek a safe haven in the Republic of Ireland. Our continued success will depend heavily on that relationship and the associated enabling powers continuing and even evolving further. The second key area is that of border policing. From a policing perspective, it is simply too early to comment on the resources necessary to support any such border control operation. However, we would assess that any infrastructure at or near the border is likely to attract protest activity and also be subject to damage and attack. We would encourage those developing solutions for the land border to bear in mind the extreme sensitivities associated with such work. The PSNI have invested heavily in reducing our security presence along the border since the ceasefires, and we have worked hard with communities to introduce a more community-style focused policing. It is essential that everything is done to maintain this position. The third area is cross-border crime. Again, it is difficult to assess the potential impact of criminality on the island of Ireland at this stage. However, it is highly likely that any increased differential in trade tariffs between North and South will be exploited by those involved for financial crime and gain. We know that the funds raised through this activity also often further organised criminality and terrorist activity. So there are real risks. Which is why the final area, that of criminal justice powers and legislation, is so critical. We currently rely on a number of European mechanisms to enable our work with An Garda Síochána and other European police services. Perhaps the most vital of these, already referenced today, is the European Arrest Warrant. It's only one of a package. But the European Arrest Warrant represents the only current mechanism for the extradition of offenders between Northern Ireland and Ireland. Just last week, we arrested a person in Northern Ireland on foot of a European Arrest Warrant issued in Dublin for someone who had committed a robbery in Athlone. So this power is used on a regular basis, not just between the Republic of Ireland and North, but between ourselves and the rest of Europe. It is therefore critical that the negotiations maintain or replicate these powers to allow us to work collaboratively with other jurisdictions in a world where criminals are less and less bounded by borders. Finally, I just want to briefly reference the concept of lawfulness. By this, I mean the concept that people are aware that the state will protect them from harm, but also that if they engage in criminality, they will have to face a sanction. One of the successes of the last 15 years is that across our two jurisdictions, we have worked hard to eliminate any sense that the border could be exploited to avoid prosecution for any offence, from road traffic breaches right up to the most serious of crimes. It is critical that this culture of lawfulness is protected and indeed enhanced on the island across both jurisdictions. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. Indeed, thank you, everyone. Just a reminder for anybody who wasn't in earlier on, if anybody wishes to submit a question, although there's plenty already in front of me, Niall, who's sitting at the back at the table, has speaker's cards. If you stick your hand up, he'll give you one. Can I start with the first question, just building a little bit on the point you've just made, Stephen, ironically came up there. How will Brexit affect the issues of child protection? Mairead may have a point on this as well, but we'll start with Stephen. Always stick the difficult questions at the peelers first. You never know when a peeler will ask you a question.
You have the right to remain silent, of course. Something in my experience you don't do very often, but... Well, and the issue of, I lead for public protection within the PSNI, so that's everything from domestic violence, sexual offences, but also the child protection issues around particularly child abuse, and also increasingly concerning is a really significant growth in recent years in the trading of child abuse imagery and online and paedophilia. So we work very closely within Garda Síochána around that. We do have an MOU, which is based under a 2002 legislation between the UK government and the Republic of Ireland government that allowed police to cooperate. So every week we are exchanging intelligence around people who pose a threat to children, particularly around sexual abuse and paedophiles. We've taken some advice. We are greatly hopeful that regardless of the post-Brexit settlement that that particular MOU will stand on the basis of that 2002 legislation. So I think that's a reassuring message. Some of the other things will fall under Brexit, but that piece will remain. I can only stress that the relationship within Garda Síochána in relation to that is very strong, but of course that type of crime is a worldwide phenomenon. We often find that people are trading these images right across the world. You know, people are sitting in other continents and trading images with paedophiles in Northern Ireland. And we're conducting search activity every month and putting people before the courts every month in relation to that crime. I wouldn't say human trafficking is an issue in these islands, and we do have people who are human trafficked into Northern Ireland for sexual abuse and also for labour abuse. There's not a massive evidence that children are trafficked into Northern Ireland on that basis. I wouldn't say it doesn't happen, but they do tend to be adults. But it's something that we're very vigilant around. So on the issue of child protection, I wouldn't single child protection out as something that gives me greater concern than some of the other issues I've touched upon. But regrettably, I will say in Northern Ireland, the issue of child abuse, and particularly around images, the increases in recent years is really quite startling. And we have people right across this country today who are trading images on the dark web and other means and buying images of children being subject to the most serious sexual offences that you can imagine.
Thank you. Reid, your point of view.
Without repeating, obviously what Stephen has already said in terms of child abuse and in terms of paedophilia and the images that are shared via the internet as well, I think what this throws up for us is again emphasising the need for robust cross-jurisdictional sharing of information in terms of data sharing and in terms of the cooperation mechanisms that already exist, but those which have to continue and be developed and expanded going forward as well to be able to tackle what is, in terms of the images on the internet, a global problem as well. So just to echo what Stephen has said in relation to that and the need to make sure that we retain those robust mechanisms.
Second question is aimed specifically at Jennifer. What is the ideal Brexit outcome for the environment sector? And could I personally add to that the point that you raised about devolution or repatriation of all powers to Westminster, and what Environment Link and Ulster Wildlife Trust have done on that, please.
To take the first part of that question, I mean, we have taken a very positive viewpoint in that whatever happens is going to happen, so we need to find a way to make it work and move things on in terms of the environment, because we have so many challenges, and some of you will have seen Blue Planet in recent months and the coverage by David Attenborough and shocking simple things like the amount of plastic in the sea, which then works its way into fish and into human diets. So there's a whole raft of issues, and we're looking at Brexit to identify those issues and to see how those can be taken forward in any post-Brexit scenario, because they need to happen. We have a big decline in our protected species. We have a disappearance of our protected habitats. Even though we have had European legislation, and many of them are still in unfavourable condition status. So as we look forward to any new environmental and agricultural policy, we're hoping and trying to use that as a vehicle for not only achieving sustainable agriculture, but also delivering for the environment and combining those two things so that it's a win-win for everyone. So the environment sector is in a slightly different place than maybe some of the other issues that we're dealing with in Brexit, but there's still huge debate, particularly around devolved competences, because agriculture and environment are currently devolved competences, that the decisions are all made by local administrations. All the indications are that that will continue. There will be probably a level of common framework which will be required for WTO agreements, because you have minimum environmental standards to deliver to even get in through the trading door, and the UK wants to be a global leader. So it's how we use Brexit to look at all those issues and find a policy solution that is simple enough to work. So lots to do, but lots of opportunities as well as lots of threats, and that's how we're approaching it.
Thanks. The next question is aimed specifically at Hugh. Just a simple one. How do you think the next few years will pan out for our universities? And could I ask you to particularly address that in the context of the work you're doing around the medical school for UU?
It's a period of uncertainty because of Brexit. And you mentioned the medical school. We're currently working with medical school in Limerick and in Galway. And I'm increasingly having conversations with them and what kind of relationship will we have post-Brexit. We're also working, as you would imagine, with all of the thrusts here in Northern Ireland. And the university is particularly interested in what's happening with cross-border health provision. So, for example, it's already been mentioned that children's services are a really good relationship between Northern Ireland and Republic of Ireland. We know, for example, the Cancer Centre in Antlegelvin is covering the northwest, and a friend of mine who is the consultant cardiologist in Antlegelvin last weekend was covering Donegal. We need to see more of that, and the university is very closely involved in that. In terms of the medical school specifically, we know that 9% of all doctors in Northern Ireland are from outside the UK, EU. What will happen post-Brexit? I'm already listening to some people who are saying that they are looking for jobs elsewhere. I'm also hearing that people, doctors and nurses from other countries are reluctant now to come to the UK, including Northern Ireland, to work simply because of Brexit. And in university, I'm getting phone calls from parents, not just in Europe, but outside Europe, in Taiwan, parents in the Middle East who are ringing up, we want to send our students to our universities here, and they're saying, well, what will happen? What will happen? Will we be able to visit our students post-Brexit? So there's a huge amount of uncertainty for the university, not just Ulster, but also Queen's and other universities in these islands. I don't think there's any chance of a solution coming anytime soon from our colleagues in government. It's tremendously worrying for us, and we have major plans in terms of infrastructure. We've major plans in terms of increasing our research profile, increasing the quality of our education and students' experience. And Brexit puts a question mark over funding for all of those things. So worrying, uncertain times.
Can I just add to that, Hugh? You said in your opening remarks that Northern Ireland was in a position of outside looking in. Do you see any way in which we can get a bit more involved in being inside participating?
Well, Northern Ireland needs to get back together its assembly, and the ministers need to be involved with the other devolved nations in being around the table to negotiate about Brexit. We're not there. They are. So our voice is not being heard. And that's, at this time, that's a shame and a disgrace, actually.
Thank you. Marie, there must be one optimist in the House. Does Brexit bring any opportunities for Northern Ireland, e.g. regarding age discrimination?
I suppose that would be one positive, but what we have to look at is the broader context, and as people have already highlighted, there are quite a range of issues and concerns. I have to say, when we spoke with the task force last week, there were a certain number of assurances given to the young people, because everywhere we had gone, and even when we were speaking with local politicians and various officials here, there's still so many unknowns at this stage, and I think people are obviously still waiting to get some kind of definites in some of the areas. But the young people were reassured in terms of that there would be no diminution of rights in terms of what was coming through from the joint report and the EU withdrawal bill. So that's encouraging. What we also have to look at, and as David's already flagged up, is the fact that we still have inequalities here that we have to address, age discrimination obviously being a key one, and certainly a key one for our office as well. So if there are opportunities, then we need to grasp them. But we also need to make sure that we preempt and put in place mitigation measures to offset any kind of adverse impact across the range of issues that we've already highlighted as well. So I suppose that's as optimistic as I can be at the minute.
Okay, the next question has been slightly answered already, but I'm going to put it back to Hugh in particular. If you could tell us what your asks are in the Brexit discussion, specifically around the Erasmus programme, and I suspect Mairead also referred to it earlier as well.
Okay. Well, our asks are to make sure that after 2020, so the funding for Horizon 2020, and I mentioned that that's 80 billion euros over its lifetime, that finishes on the 31st of December 2020. After that, we don't know. And as I said at the outset, that the UK draws down, it's the second largest country that draws down money from those sources. So we need to get a deal done between the European Commission and the UK government as to what's going to happen after 2020. And it's not just Horizon 2020, it is Interreg. It's about peace funding. There's lots of funding coming to Northern Ireland that is going to have a huge question mark over it after the 31st of December 2020. And we need that deal done. Otherwise, we are going to be in major difficulties sustaining our current provision of research and education as world-leading universities.
Just to mention, we did get assurances from the task force last week that they were actually looking at ways to address this concern, because obviously, for obvious reasons, and Hugh's already outlined them, there are very real issues around this. I suppose one of the things that we've also heard that I should share with people as well is I know that the Westminster government is looking at a special funding stream. I know that it will be based on merit in terms of some of the funding streams we currently have from Europe. So there is encouragement and I suppose a note of optimism in there, David, just to go back to the note of optimism, that the UK government may continue some of the funding streams, but it will be based on the merit principle as well. So we have to look at that in the round. I do think that the task force and those who are negotiating are doing their best. We are aware that Northern Ireland was always a net beneficiary in terms of EU funding, and it's whether or not the Westminster government will be able to step up or will want to step up in relation to the funding streams that we've had in place to date, and only time will tell on that one.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to give a personal preamble to this one. Stephen, you'll be pleased to know. I mentioned the meeting we had in Dublin a few months back. At that, one of the officials from the Department of Justice and Equality said that if Ireland had to reproduce all the existing European legislation covering justice matters to deal with North-South issues, he reckoned they could probably do it in about 5 years if the Department of Justice had no other policy work to do. Stephen, in the light of that kind of comment, can you tell us what level of engagement you have and hope to continue having with organisations like Europol and maintaining those contacts with other European police services and how you see that panning out, not in the sense for you for the legislation, but for the practical work that needs to be done?
Well, I think that's a big risk, and I highlighted that in my opening remarks. And the easy answer to that question is it depends on what happens with Brexit. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, we enjoy access to a whole range of criminal justice measures. So European arrest warrant, we have the ability to access criminal records right across Europe. We have the ability through the Schengen information system too to put on alerts that people are wanted. We can see who's wanted across all the other EU countries. We can put out to all European countries details of property that is required. We can put out sensitive flags, which means if someone comes to a border and they're subject of investigation in one country, that the people at that, when they're entering those countries, can see that. There's a whole host of joint investigation teams, and we do that. We have carried out joint investigation teams with police services in the Balkans around human trafficking. For example, we enjoy access to all these. There's new, the PRUM developments, where you can have immediate access to fingerprint, DNA, data right across Europe. Whatever happens post-Brexit, whether they're called different by different names, whether they're under different legislation, we need to have that package of measures replicated. Europol is an organisation that allows, where crime affects more than one country, it can act as a catalyst to bring those countries together and facilitate effective investigation and sharing of information. But it is, the name's in the title, Euro. We don't know whether we will have access to Europol post-Brexit. We certainly want to have access to it. So it really is very uncertain. And, you know, whilst I was optimistic in my first answer around the child protection issues between North and South, there are many other crimes that will be frustrated, and our ability to tackle them will be frustrated if we don't have these package of measures replicated. And the thought of the British government having to make a whole host of individual bilateral treaties with the other countries around all these range of issues is quite simply daunting. And I talked about the concept of lawfulness. At the minute, if a man commits a rape in the Republic of Ireland and flees north, we will cooperate with An Garda Síochána on foot of European legislation, mm-hmm, to ensure that that man can be arrested in the north and actually tried in the north if that is what's needed, or on foot of a European arrest warrant, taken back down south. And the exact same can happen if the crime commits in the north and they flee south. I want that concept of lawfulness. People need to know that the law will follow swiftly upon their heels, that we will be after them, that we have the powers and legislation to make them amenable for their crimes. And I do think that the whole uncertainty around Brexit is a concern in that regard.
Thank you. Not for the content, but for saying it so clearly. Jennifer, I know that there's work going on across a range of partners within Environment Link, you know, obviously your own Ulster Wildlife Trust, but others. Could you tell us something about how environment organisations are working together on Brexit issues at the moment?
This briefly earlier, but all the main organisations in the environment sector, including Northern Ireland Environment Link, of which I'm vice chair, also Ulster Wildlife Trust, National Trust, RSPB, some of the other AOMB organisations are all working together so that we can try and collectively find the best way forward and feed a consistent message into government as to what would work in the future and what we expect as ENGOs. And the same is happening in the other regions of the UK, so there's a whole network happening. So we have a coalition in Northern Ireland called Nature Matters, NI. We have a coalition at a UK level called Greener UK, and then there's all sorts of quite complex structures as to how we feed into those processes. And then in addition to that, many of us will also sit on UK boards. So for example, I'm a trustee on the Wildlife Trust UK board in England. So very often we'll be back and forth with Westminster politicians, as well as meeting our own politicians. So there's lots happening, but the scale and scope of the environmental issues is huge. So DEFRA, for example, have brought in 1,200 people into England's team to work on Brexit in Northern Ireland and the other devolved regions. There has been no funds allocated as yet to support that Brexit work. And that's a real challenge, because what we don't want, we do need to link in with the rest of the UK to make things happen, but we need to have them bespoke to the needs of Northern Ireland, and that takes time, resource and money.
Thank you. We've had almost an hour of discussion on this. I'm now going to be utterly unfair because the panel is completely unaware that I'm about to spring this on them. I've got my watch out. I'm going to give you, each of you, 30 seconds to say what you think the best could be done at the present time is. And to give you a hint, I'll give you 30 seconds thinking time. And my answer is quite simple. I stand with my friend Owen Smith. A second referendum, now we know what the details are, an exit from Brexit. I better keep ingratiated with Stephen, so I'll take you last. Professor McKenna, sir, Hugh, would you like to start? Go.
It's going to be very simple. I would agree that we need a second referendum. I would also agree that we need our assembly around the table. I do a lot of travelling in my job, and to some extent we're the laughing stock of Europe. I was in Cyprus recently, and Cyprus is it's a divided country, and they keep, in Nicosia they were saying, what's happening in Northern Ireland? Why can you guys not get your act together? So we need to do that as well as a second referendum.
Very quickly, because I wasn't expecting this, I do think that one of the things that we'd say is that we have to make sure that we future-proof whatever comes out of this whole process. I can't actually take a side one way or the other on this, but it is very much having an eye to what will the future look like for our children and young people, and that's as much as I'd like to say. Thanks.
And I would like to endorse that, because environmental issues, they're actually not going to affect They will affect our generation, but they'll affect the next several generations. So they're very serious issues that we need to think about. And we certainly would all like to see an assembly back up and running to get the communication going.
Stephen.
Okay, I have three asks. One I've already spoken at length around the criminal justice measures. Secondly, is that they get the issue around the customs union and the single market issues sorted so that there is absolutely no infrastructure at our land border with the Republic of Ireland, because I do fear that any infrastructure, people, persons, buildings, checking, regimes, whatever they look like, will re-emphasize the border, create all sorts of destabilization in that area, and will inevitably end up with attacks from distant Republicans. That will suck us in, even if the issues are for HMRC and Border Force primarily,
keep going,
and not us, that it will suck us in, and then the risks increase, and we have imagery associated with the past that will be unhelpful. Third ask is, I think the peace funding has been very helpful to build relationships between the police and communities, as well as building community capacity, and I would like to see some of that continue.
Thank you. Can I say thank you to all our panel, especially for the way they responded to that last unfair question? I certainly think this morning has been useful in highlighting a range of issues. Sadly, I'm not sure that, frankly, the people who ought to be listening in Whitehall are actually listening to the kind of expertise which is on this platform at the moment. But thank you to all four of our guests for their participation.